So yeah, the radio show is just, it's, I mean, I started it mostly because I'm just interested in natural history stuff and hoping that other people who are sort of interested but maybe don't realize that other people might be interested in what they're seeing or hear it and you know, sort of share more of their stuff. So I've only done a few of them so far, so I won't say that it's a super smooth thing for me at this point. But
well, you've got a wonderful website. I was really impressed.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's been it's kind of where I spend more time maybe than I should, but yeah, I guess it's my hobby and it's a big time sink, but yeah, that's where I learn stuff I found by taking pictures of things and then you know, figuring it out when I get home, sort of thing. So
yeah, that's sort of the way I do things. So that's neat.
Yeah, it seems like, well, you've been taking pictures for a long time, I guess. It seems like, when did you move to Alaska?
I moved here in 1960.
Oh, okay. So, and that was to work for Fish and Game?
Yeah, I was going to the University of Washington School of Fisheries, and there was an announcement on the bulletin board, jobs available in Alaska, $500 a month. So I temporarily dropped out of school and flew up here and accepted a job.
Oh, nice. Were you taking pictures in the very beginning?
Yes. Ever since I was a kid, I was always interested in photography and always took a camera with me on backpacking trips and stuff and liked to document what I saw. But when I moved here, I got particularly interested in birds and purchased a big Leicaflex telephoto lens, complete with a gunstock mount and everything.
Wow. So you, and then of course you wrote the Birds of Alaska book. I guess I'm not sure when that was first edition of that was published. Seems like it's been through two or three editions. Maybe
yeah,
more.
That came out first in 1980.
Okay.
And then I think it's on its fifth edition now.
Fifth edition, wow. I've seen, I guess I haven't seen the most recent edition. I think I have maybe the second and third edition, or maybe it's the second and fourth. Or it looks like
your
picture's upgraded over the years.
Yeah, I think the recent edition is my most favorite. The publisher was having some financial problems, and so I agreed to do all the design and gather all the photos and everything myself. And so I made an attempt to purchase the best photographs I could find, the ones that I didn't have photos of, and so I think it turned out a lot better than the previous editions.
Do you keep track of like a running count or anything of what all you have photographs of?
Not really. I file them by species in the computer. I really don't know. I think I've photographed maybe close to 300 species in the state.
For birds?
Oh, birds, yeah.
Yeah, that's for me. I've been I don't travel too much around the state. I and actually when I have gone to Juneau or someplace else, I don't do too much. I mean, I just wander around. Don't really worry about taking pictures. I'm for whatever reason much more interested in kind of documenting locally in the Sitka area, and so I'm you know, they have the Alaska 200 Club for the state, and I think my goal is to get Sitka 200. You know, I'll join the Alaska 200 Club when I have 200 species in Sitka that I've managed to. Almost all of them I'll have photographs of at that point. I think I'm 170 or something like that, with a handful of other ones that I've heard or seen but not managed to get a picture of. So, but I kind of keep track of that on the website. It makes it a little easier for me, so it kind of automatically gets tracked that way.
Yeah, at one time they had a category for number of species photographed in the state.
Oh,
And
wow.
that's when I was real excited about it because I thought I was the first person to reach over 200 species with identifiable photographs. And that was quite some time ago. But then they dropped that category.
Oh. Yeah, I hadn't noticed it on there. So that was, yeah, it would be kind of fun to do that way. It's, I don't know. I liked it. Well, and of course you take pictures more than just birds too, right?
Oh yeah, anything to do with nature, I'm interested in, and even little tiny things, insects. And I had a thrill the other day. I was up in the Alpine, and there was a mite crawling around, and I was able to take a photograph of an Alpine mite. I don't know anything about it, but now that I have a photograph of it, maybe I can find out what it is and learn a little bit more about them.
Have you ever used bugguide.net?
Yeah, not extensively. I know you can post photos on it, can't you? And then
Yeah.
and various people or experts throughout even the world can chime in as to their possible identification. And
Yeah, that's something I've been doing. I haven't kept up with all my pictures from this year so far, but I definitely have gotten some identifications or even partial identifications, you know, that I would have never been able to figure out on my own, and it's been a really useful resource that way. Not a whole, there's a handful of other people that have posted pictures from Alaska, but not very many, and I think most were kind of traveling through, but there's at least a couple other people I think that live in the state, or actually three or four that I can think of that have posted. Derek Sykes with the university has posted quite a few of their specimen collect, you know, the specimens in their collection from the state. He's posted on Bug Guide, which has been kind of nice to have as a reference also.
Yes, and I have often in the past I've sent photos to him, and most of the time he can tell me what they are. But he's been encouraging me to use that BugNet guide quite a bit. And then there's an entomologist here, John Hudson, who is real good with aquatic insects. And of course, dragonflies. But you get involved with the diptera or the flies, and boy, some of them are really hard to identify. So
Yeah,
it
that's.
has that bug net guide.
Yeah, it's I this year I kind of had taken it upon myself as a project to try and document 1,000 species, which in this case a lot of them are ones that I've already photographed, so the documentation's just recording an observation of them, but it's still in order to be successful, I'll probably have to get probably close to 500, you know, species that are new to me, and since I don't know what they are, it's generally I take pictures of them and try and figure out, you know, I even if I don't get a name, you know, as long as I can recognize it as something that I've seen here, that's okay for me for now. So, but the flies are one of those the groups that are. It's just hard, you know, that some flies aren't so bad. The hover flies, the bee mimic or far flies are those are kind of fun and seem distinct enough that, but all those sort of generic kind of house looking flies or I don't even really know. I think there's actually several groups that kind of look like that, but yeah, it's a challenge to try and it seems like a lot of those maybe have aquatic. I remember Kathy Hawker came and did a talk on, well, she did a couple things. She did a workshop on you know, natural history illustration, and then and did talk on the aquatic invertebrates, and she said she'd gotten most of the photos. I think she'd gotten from you that you guys were working on book. And I don't know what the status of that book is. Is it coming out soon?
It's out.
Oh, is it? Okay, I'll have to look for it.
Aquatic Insects in Alaska by John Hudson and Kathy Hawker and myself, but it's a 140-page full-color book. And Kathy wrote most of the introductory information, and she really did a nice job. She's condensed and written so the average person can understand what's going on, and talks about their life history and how they survived the freezing elements and such. And then John pretty well wrote the sections on the different families of aquatic insects that occur in the state. And again,
so is it statewide then?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you have, is there broken out by what regions they occur in, or is it pretty much just like family level and so they occur kind of throughout the state?
It's to the family level. We mention sometimes when they're only known from one particular place. Like there's a species of a caddisfly that lives in Nugget Falls near Menindee Glacier, on the real steep areas where the water really rushes. And as far as we know, the only place that one's ever been found is exactly there.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder sometimes, you know, this year I've been taking a lot of pictures of moths and you know, I don't find matches. So there's some pretty decent resources on the internet with photographs of moths, and you know, I've been struck by a couple of things. One is the diversity of them. I never really, you know, realized. And I'm just finding the ones that are mostly coming to lights and ending up on the walls where there are lights on at night. So I'm sure there's lots of other kinds that aren't attracted to light. But it's kind of amazing how many different things are here. And some of them you see a lot of, you know, for a short period. Some of them you see throughout a longer period. Some of them I've only seen once. And it's, you know, I have to imagine there's a lot of things that are, you know, not previously known to occur, and perhaps not even previously described species of you know, insects and other terrestrial arthropods and aquatic arthropods.
Oh yeah, the even working on dragonflies, it seems like every year we discover one or two new species for the state. Anyway, but. Yeah, moths are very fascinating. There's the one that, particularly in the fall, I think they come under the classification of winter moths that come to lights and things. And the female doesn't have any wings, and it's only the males that are coming in. And the female sits in the area where she wants to lay an egg and emits these probably pheromones to attract the males. And then after mating, she doesn't have to travel very far in order to lay her eggs. And I've been looking and looking and looking for the females, but I haven't found any yet. And
are those the ones that show up in like November, December? I mean,
yes.
Think that's when I've seen them here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think I first noticed those maybe last winter, maybe it was the winter before last, and I think it seemed like you had written something about them, because I remember finding something, the Bruce Spanworm, I think is what they're called.
I think Mary Wilson wrote an article on it for the Juno Empire. And
I'll bet that's where I saw it then.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it seemed interesting. I couldn't figure out how they could disperse out to an island, and then so I asked about it, I think on Bug Guide, and they said, oh, well, the caterpillars actually kind of do ballooning like spiders do.
Oh,
And
yeah.
so that's how they can disperse, and I hadn't thought of that.
Have you ever seen one of those forester moths?
I'm not sure which ones those are. I don't know.
I saw them for the first time this year, but they're fairly large, maybe a couple inch wingspan, but they're black with white oval spots on their wings, and they're really quite attractive. And, I've only found maybe three of them, but they seem to inhabit some of the beachside vegetation.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen, I don't remember seeing one that quite looks like that. I've seen a lot of different things, like I say, this year, and I don't even walk a very big area, but I, you know, just go on, you know, more days than not, and checking what's there on the walls. I've found a lot of stuff. So it's possible I've seen that one, but I'm not sure. I haven't got all my pictures processed and posted yet, so I couldn't direct you to them to see if you recognized it or any of them for those. But it's one of the things I'm actually kind of curious about, and I don't know if you had a chance to look at the wiki website if you have, but that's you know, originally I started that to just be for Sitka area, and then I thought, well, there's a lot of overlap between the Sitka area and the rest of the Southeast, so I'll just go ahead, and if I can find the resources, I'll add for the rest of the Southeast as well. Maybe some other folks will contribute, but that's one of the things I'm sort of fascinated by is you know, how things are different from, you know, place to place, and it was I'll tell a story about Lucy Phillips is a local birder and has been on the show a couple times. She when she first started birding, she lived out at Medvete Hatchery, which is it's out of town a little ways. It's on the road system, but behind a gated road. And she saw she sent in this report to the birding email list and mentioned all these nice things that she'd been seeing out at Stargaven, and then sort of in passing mentioned seeing a mountain bluebird. And mountain bluebird, I mean, that was essentially the third report for Sitka ever, and I think the first one for fall. And it had been out there for about 4 days, and so she'd had a lot of chance to study it and stuff. And but she'd been looking in the Birds of Alaska book, which mentioned, I think it had them as uncommon for Southeast Alaska, so she just figured that it was, you know, no big deal, and so she didn't report it till after it was gone, and there were some people that were a little irritated because they would have liked to have gone and seen it, and it's just one of those things where, you know, they aren't that hard to find in Juneau and, you know, Skagway or Haines at certain times of year, but, you know, elsewhere in Southeast, they might be really unusual, whereas conversely, we might see, I think there are some species that are out here that you really hardly ever get it all in Juneau, so that's part of what's fascinating to me, is this relatively small distances and you know, distinct differences in both animals and plants. You know, when I visited Juneau, it seemed like the vegetation, it's still clearly rainforest, you know, temperate coniferous rainforest with the spruces and the hemlocks, composition of the shrubs seems to be a little different. Some things are more abundant than I see here, and other things less so. So I find that really interesting, and that's, I'm hoping that people, you know, I hope there's more people like you that are interested in, you know, everything that's out there and like to document it and talk about it, because it sure makes it a lot more interesting to, you know, compare it to me anyway.
I think that's one of the exciting things about photography is you might not have the foggiest idea what you're looking at, but you can take a photo of it, and then you can sometimes find out what it is, and then that leads to finding out what its role is in the overall ecosystem and where it comes from and what its behavior is, and And so you begin to build quite a foundation of knowledge, and I think that's what, to me, that's what really excites me about photography, is not necessarily getting a particular image, but having it lead to learning so much more.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I've used my photography primarily as a tool to learn to recognize what I'm seeing out there. And in the long run, I sort of stop taking pictures of stuff unless it just happens to be, once I recognize it, and then I just start to pay attention to it. Unless it happens to be like this perfect setup or something, I'm more interested in just recognizing it, noticing where it is, and what it's doing. And like today, I noticed I did take pictures of this. I was walking, and I was checking out one of the places that the moths like to end up. And I was stepping down the stairs, and this thing just fell right by me. And I looked at what it was, and it was a yellow jacket. I think it was I can't I recognize it, but I don't remember which name it is. I think there's at least three different ones I've seen here, but. And it was it had grabbed at one of the big crane flies, and was actually, as I watched it, in a matter of seconds, it dismembered. It clipped off all its legs and wings, and then took the body and flew off.
Oh.
And yeah, it was kind of, I got some mediocre pictures of it, but it was fun to just even get something to help remember it by. And I've seen them scratching on wood to make their, where they'll get the fiber for their nest, and I mostly see those yellow jackets on flowers, and I assume eating pollen. But I guess maybe they need to feed the protein stuff to their young or something, I don't know. But that's something I want to research a little more. So recognizing these things, and then it's finding all the links, it's, for me, recognizing them is kind of getting to know your neighbors, and then the fascinating part is all that comes after that. Once you recognize neighbors, it's, what are they doing, and how are they
Right.
interacting?
I had a one fascinating photography thing that happened maybe a month ago, but I'd like to tell you about. I was on a whale watching boat, and the driver said, "Oh, there's a sea otter out there, which is unusual for Juneau." And so that got me real excited, and I ran up on deck and got the camera ready. And there was a sea otter, a harbor seal, and a sea lion all together. And the sea otter was holding the seal on its breast, and the sea lion appeared to be trying to get the seal. And so the sea otter was swimming rapidly away from it, and the sea lion was charging them. And I was taking pictures like crazy. Other people were documenting it mentally by watching it continually with binoculars. But when I came home and looked at the photos on the computer, what I found out was that the seal had a rope around its neck, and it appeared that the sea otter was definitely protecting it from the sea lion. And I thought that was a very bizarre connection, but had I not been taking photographs, I never would have noticed that rope. It's
That is
probably
really
part of a
interesting.
gill net or something,
So you don't have sea otters very much there. Have you ever heard of sea lions attacking seals before?
I got on looked in the literature, and it apparently is fairly common that sea lions will attack seals, but it's there. I could find nothing of any records of sea lions really going after sea otters.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, we have plenty of each here in Sitka, quite a few sea otters, but I've never really seen any of the three directly interacting, I guess. Not that I spend a lot of time out on the water, but Yeah, that's an interesting observation there. That makes me, it's, I wonder how often people see those sort of things, and they maybe see them but don't think to tell anybody, and it never really goes anywhere. I wonder how much stuff's going on that we just that I have no idea about because I didn't happen to see it.
But without the photos documenting it, probably no one would believe you
Right.
because it's such a bizarre thing happening.
Yeah, the nice thing about the photos, it slows things down a little bit. You have a chance to look and study it a little closer without all the motion. And I've had that experience also where I noticed things in the picture. The one that is kind of a trivial little thing, but many times it's happened that I take pictures of flowers or I take pictures of mushrooms, and then I start looking at the pictures, and I notice the small, most often little springtails, but sometimes small snails. And I think, man, why couldn't I seen those at the time? I would have taken a better picture of them, because they were interesting also. But over the years, I've finally tried I finally had that happen enough times that I pay a little more attention in the moment, and so I can try and take pictures of the smaller things also. But how often it's or how easy it is to overlook things, and then with the leisure at home, it's not like I can go back and pay more attention at the time, but it helps me remember for future observations.
I know I
Look a
was
little
once
closer.
looking in a pond and just kind of trying to see what I could see, and I noticed I took some photos of a snail, and I wasn't quite sure what it was doing, but it looked like it was upside down. And when I analyzed the photo, I realized that it was crawling upside down on the surface film, and I didn't know that snails could do this.
So it was on the underside of the water, but still like crawling on the bottom of the surface, basically.
Yes,
Oh, very interesting. I wouldn't have guessed that they could do that either.
And I actually talked to John Hudson about it, and he says, "Oh yeah, that's what snails are capable of doing that." And so
I'll
it's
have to look out
very,
for that then.
yeah, it's hard to see because they, blend in so well, but that's where photography helps.
Yeah, it's been I mean that's the nice thing these days about even for macro stuff especially it's you don't even have to have a super expensive camera if you the little digital point and shoots can do reasonable macro stuff and you can have a chance it's nice to have a nicer setup but it has its disadvantages too and just in terms of getting everything set up and carrying it, packing it all around, and for people that are interested in documenting things, a relatively inexpensive point and shoot with a good macro setting can open a lot of things to photography without a lot of strain in either the wallet or
Yeah,
the backpack.
definitely. They're wonderful for macro. And there's something out there. I don't know whether you're familiar with it. You familiar with what's called a super macro?
I haven't heard that term.
What it is it clips on the end of a regular prosumer type camera, the sort of larger point and shoots. And what it does is it allows you to photograph insects and such from maybe 4 to 6 inches away, and you can full frame something only a couple millimeters long. Very easy to full frame a mosquito with it. But the advantage of them is that you're not right up next to them, so you can photograph them at a distance at which they're usually comfortable with your presence. And so it really increases the probability of getting good photos of small insects. And the real advantage of it is that it's relatively inexpensive. They cost about $50. and they're very high quality. All they do is you can carry one with you. They're very light, and so you can just snap it on the end of your point and shoot camera, and it increases the chances of getting good photos of insects and small things quite a bit.
Yeah, and that can definitely be a challenge. Some of them, it's actually been interesting, the moths, Stephen. I mean, my strategy this year is I catch them in a little container and bring them home and photograph them at home, where I can have a little setup where I actually put them between two kind of 77-millimeter UV filters, so they're just clear. And I put them between two of those, so it's got enough gap there for them to sit there comfortably, but they can't fly away either. So,
that's a good idea.
Yeah, if they're really calm, I'll just lift one, and then I just have a grid background, and then I also do it with a white and a black background. But you know, so it's not a natural background, but it's nice for just being able to see them. But it's been interesting to me how different species seem to have fairly consistent traits in, I guess it shouldn't be surprising, but like some of them are really prone to flight. And when I walk up, like if I'm not ready with the container and just stick it on there, they'll take off. Whereas other ones, they'll just sit there. Some of them you can even knock down and they'll just kind of flutter to the ground and still sit there. And it just the differences between species in terms of their response to approach. And I've noticed that a little bit with flies. I haven't done as much. I mean, it's a little hard. Flies seem to be more wary in general, and it's hard to get close enough to them to get pictures in many cases. But yeah, it's been an interesting thing to just kind of observe that. I wouldn't have. I mean, in hindsight, it seems like it should be pretty obvious, but I wouldn't have guessed that ahead of time.
And one of my favorite places to visit are railings of bridges. Particularly over streams, they seem to a lot of different insects and even spiders seem to sit on the railings. And if you can avoid your shadow falling over them, you can often get very close to them with a camera, and you can rest the camera on the railing, which helps. And that's one trick I've used. Over the years, for particularly aquatic insects, the adult phases, when they emerge, they'll often come up and sit on the bridge railings and such.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess I haven't ever checked out the bridge at Totem Park here. It goes across Indian River. It's right by where I walk several times a week usually, and I'll have to start looking for the. I've got pictures of a few caddisflies this year and some stoneflies, more than I had in previously, but I haven't come close to identifying any of them really. I guess I have a genus for a couple of them that I had seen before, but yeah, it's keeping up. Like I say, I was trying to find 1,000 species in this year, and so the you know, just kind of as a generic round number, but. I'm finding the hard part is keeping up with all the document. I mean, I got the pictures, but it's getting through them and getting them posted and trying to get identified, you know, going through and looking to see if I can find a good match. And that's all, that's probably going to have to wait until there's a little less daylight and a little less activity.
Yes. And there's one really wonderful book out on tracks and signs of insects that you might be aware of. I can't remember the author, but it goes into even the eggs that certain insects lay and the cocoons they build and some of the tracks that they make. I think
the guy, what isn't one of the author's names, I think is Charlie, I want to say Eisman or something like that.
You might be right.
Yeah, and he has a web blog that's really interesting also that I've been following. And he posts, you know, he posts pictures of a lot of gall wasp, or, I mean galls and the insects, I guess they're not always wasps, and then the parasitoids and the hyperparasitoids, I guess, and it's these things that he's gotten. I kind of was inspired by that a little bit this year, and I've collected a few leaves that had leaf miners in them, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, what's making the what's doing the leaf mining, and mostly I've noticed it in cow parsnip, but also in the spear scale atriplex that grows on the beach here at the park, and I've seen it a few other places. I don't know if it's around Juneau much, but it also seems to have a lot of kind of leaf miners, and they look like they're different kinds, but I don't know if they're moths or I assume that maybe they are, but I don't really know. So yeah, I'm hoping that I've got a cocoon or two that came from one of them, and I'm waiting to see if something emerges. I don't know if it'll be this year or next year or what, but.
Yeah, that's fun. I often, I have a few, like 2.5 gallon aquariums that I will either put dirt or things in and collect some things and then just put them in there and see what happens. And I put in the cocoon of I wasn't quite sure what it was and left it in the dirt for actually over winter outside, and it was in the dirt for about 9 months, and eventually one day I looked and they were these beautiful hawk moths that had emerged.
Oh wow! Yeah, I've seen one adult and I've seen one caterpillar of those, but I have they don't seem to be very common around Sitka anyway, or at least
yeah,
I haven't seen them much.
Their caterpillars are those hookworms, very beautiful.
Yeah.
But it's just fun doing things like that.
Yeah. My son last year found a big green caterpillar, and it was crawling on the sidewalk, and so he brought it home, and we tried to guess what it might want to eat, and it didn't seem to want to eat, and then it occurred to me that maybe it was on the sidewalk for a reason, and so we just put it in got a bucket with dirt and set it on top, and it immediately burrowed right down into the dirt. So I just put that bucket in one of these, you know, they make these mesh rearing pavilions, and just left it in there out on the porch, and that one actually was it didn't take that long. I think it was maybe a month, and it emerged as an adult. My kids came in one day and said they asked me something, and they noticed that they checked it, I think, every day when they came in the door there.
Uh-huh.
They said, "Oh, there's a moth. It came out," and so we looked at it, and sure enough, and we were able to identify it from the adult. So that was kind of fun. And also, sword grass moth, I think, is what the common name for it was. But kind of a big, not super showy, but interesting. One I hadn't seen before, and actually haven't seen since. So,
one thing that's exciting to do is to raise mosquitoes. It's exciting from the photography standpoint because because when they emerge, they only take about 5 minutes.
Oh, wow. So that's pretty fast.
In fact, I think it's even faster than that. But then I've raised them in the house before. And if you have the water close to the top of the aquarium, then you can photograph them without having to shoot through glass or anything.
Yeah.
So you can get them coming out of their pupil skin right on the surface of the water. And it's probably good to do that sort of towards the fall, because then you have the mosquito that's called a snow mosquito that overwinters as an adult and doesn't seek a blood meal until the following year.
Oh, until the spring, yeah. So how do you time that?
I beg your pardon?
I say, how do you time that to make sure that that's what you're getting instead of the...
Well, the later in the year, the better. The more you're apt to... Because they tend to come out late in the winter, and they overwinter as adults. But the probability of getting having one a female pershrew in the house is much less if they're one of those snow mosquitoes.
So how do you know? Do you have, or maybe nobody does, but do you know if anybody has any idea how many species of mosquito there are in the state, or maybe, or even just southeast?
One thing the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, the museum under Derek Sykes, keeps a complete list of all insects found in the state. And that's a wonderful way to narrow things down. And they do it by family. And so, and he keeps it updated quite a bit. But, and I think you can download that off the internet. It's quite a large PDF document, but it can really help in narrowing the what you have. And that would list all the mosquito species that have been found in the state. But I don't have it on the top of my head. I don't know how many there are here.
Yeah,
I'm sure there's a number.
Yeah, it's easy. I think, like everybody, things that I'm not familiar with, it's easy to assume they're simpler than they probably are, in fact. And you know, kind of generically, a mosquito, I know that there are different mosquitoes, you know, worldwide, that some, you know, carry diseases, and those are more tropical, and the ones we have up here aren't those species. But I didn't, you know, I hadn't really ever thought about, you know, how many different species there might be here, and what the difference is, and I don't know, timing or what it is that you know, how they're fitting into different sort of niches ecologically, I suppose, and so yeah, it'd be interesting to. I don't have a lot of pictures of mosquitoes. I've quite been bold enough to let them bite me and take pictures while they're doing it. I think that's, they seem to like to die off.
The only way I was able to get a picture of a no-see-um, which you can barely see with your eyes, was to have one bite me and get the camera right up next to it.
Yeah, I wonder if there's multiple species of those too, I guess. I tend to think of them as all being the same also, but I suppose they may not be.
No, I'm sure there are many species. John Hudson's father is an expert on chironomids, which is a midges in the order Diptera or flies. And John captures him here in Juneau and then sends him samples. And he's always coming up with new species, sometimes even new species for the world.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know if I could recognize it. I mean, there are things that I think of as midges, but I don't really have it clear in my head as to whether or not that's what they are. I'll have to get you guys' book and read up on it and have a better sense of what I'm looking at.
Yeah, often when you, sort of towards the evening, when you get near streams and you see these big swarms of insects flying about, usually they're midges.
Okay.
And the nice thing about them is that they're the non-biting type. And so their main purpose is in reproduction.
Yeah. Do they have a long adult lifespan, or are they pretty short-lived?
Very short. Usually, just after mating, the adult lays eggs pretty quickly, and and then both of them die.
So they probably go through multiple hatches per year then. I guess maybe they spend most of the time as larvae.
Yeah, usually these types of insects can spend sometimes years as an aquatic, in the aquatic form. And then, like most chironomids, live only a few days. And many of them don't even have mouth parts.
So do you try and take pictures of the adults of those?
Uh-huh.
And do you have any tricks for doing that successfully? I've noticed the flies, when I've caught them, I don't always get to them fast enough. They die pretty quickly, I've found. But even then, they tend to be so leggy that it's hard to get, like, good focus on the whole thing.
Yeah, one of the best ways to get photographs of the adults of aquatic insects is to put their larvae in an aquarium. And then when they emerge or change into an adult, they sit on the water surface for a while before taking flight. And then you can usually get a good photo at that point.
That makes sense. Well, I should probably ask you about also, so this coming week here is the BioBlitz. Well, I guess it's a week and a half away from this conversation here, but Sunday I'll be on the radio. And you're coming to do the sort of the kickoff seminar slideshow talk on Friday, and I don't remember, let's see, what was the title of that? It was Connections.
Generally just Connections in Nature.
In Nature, right. Okay.
Generally at BioBlitz, the purpose is identifying as many species as they can find. And so what I was mostly going to talk about was once you've identified something, then trying to learn about it, learn about its connections in nature and how it fits into the overall ecosystem and that sort of thing.
I guess we've already talked a little bit about some of the kind of things that you've discovered even recently. Seems like you find that you're discovering new connections all the time as you're out on your walks and observing.
Oh, yes. one thing I've been fascinated with lately is is marmots. And we have in Juneau, we have a lot that live along the beach, and then a lot that live in the alpine. And I've been interested in trying to compare the differences between them as far as behavior. And so right now it's mostly just taking photographs and watching and trying to learn about them. And one thing I've noticed is that the beach marmots, the ones that live along beaches, seem to have no fear of bald eagles, even though bald eagles perch right over where they're playing and such. And but in the alpine, if one flies over, they usually let out their whistle and dive into their den. And so that's been fascinating to watch. And the ones that live along the beaches seem to be much more relaxed. So they don't appear to be preyed upon as much as the ones in the alpine. And I don't know whether colonizing beaches is a more recent evolutionary thing with them or anything about it. But it would be fun to have a biologists someday study the two different groups and see what the connections are between where they live. So that's been fun to do.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that the marmots were, I mean, I knew they were up in the Alpine there, but I didn't realize there was a population that was down on the beaches as well.
I don't know whether it's just a Juneau thing or whether it's common elsewhere on the mainland, but very common along the beaches in Juneau.
I mean, it's easy, I guess it's easy to come up with sort of plausible seeming hypotheses for why they might be more relaxed. I mean, there's definitely more eagles down low than there is in the Alpine. So they would just have more opportunity to get used to them. And maybe there are other raptor predators in the Alpine that are, you know, are, I don't know if hawks or something like that might go after them up there that aren't so
Now
numerous
that's a
down.
good point.
So.
It might be. I know golden eagles in particular would probably go after marmots, and golden eagles typically hunt in the Alpine and not along the beaches. So you might be right. It might be any aerial large bird might be real frightful to them in the Alpine, but not along the beaches. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I mean, these kind of questions and stuff are always it's sort of endlessly fascinating to me, and it's I think the conversations that people have just from you know what's part of what's so interesting is that it doesn't you know doesn't take somebody with a you know graduate degrees in mammalogy or any kind of biology really. All it takes is sort of paying attention over time, and you can almost be assured that you'll find things that no scientist has ever observed or noted before, and probably lots of things of that sort. And finding a group of people that are also interested in the same sorts of things is, you know, makes it that much more sort of enjoyable. You get to, you know, toss back and forth ideas about what could be going on, and then of course more eyes means more opportunities to, you know, see more stuff going on and get a better idea of how things might be working.
Yeah, I know. I just get fascinated by just sitting and watching, and the other day I was watching a bald eagle on the flats, and it was an immature bald eagle, and it was seemed to be chewing on something that didn't make much sense. I thought it was a fish, but there was a raven with it, and the raven would go right up to the face of the bald eagle and caw at it, and then it would go around to the side and caw at it, and then it would go to the back of it and pull its tail. And it
It
did
actually
this
pulled the
for
eagle's tail.
the raven would pull the eagle's tail, yes.
Wow.
And then eventually it drove the eagle off what it was chewing on, and the raven went over and stood on it and then looked at the eagle and started cawing at it with its feathers on its top of its head raised up. But then in the photographs, I actually was videotaping it. It was a piece of wood,
Huh.
and it was sort of like the raven just wanted it and wanted to play with it a little bit, and then eventually he drove the eagle completely away. But I was amazed at how close he would get to it.
Yeah, I watched something like that happen, except in this case, Eagle had a part of a fish carcass, and it was perched in a tree, and a raven just came up, and you know the eagle is so much bigger than the raven. All the raven could really do was harass it, but that was enough. It after a few minutes, the eagle just took off and it left the fish, and the raven
uh-huh.
and took it. And you think, man, that's.
I've even seen a pair of ravens harass a bear in a tree, and
oh, wow.
causing it to drop a fish. And then it went down and started feeding on the fish. But
ravens are usually pretty good at knowing their limits, but I've heard of at least a couple different times where people have seen ravens that got a little too close to an eagle in flight, and the eagle was able to grab it out of the air and then ate the raven. I've never actually seen that myself, but I've heard a couple of different people tell me about seeing that happen.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's in the alpine here, when we get weather where you can get up there and see things. Anyway, on a clear day, the bald eagles will be soaring back and forth, and the ravens will be up there soaring, and the ravens often start interacting with the eagles and kind of dive bombing them and such. But I've never observed an eagle taking a raven, but I've heard of other people who, like you said, have seen that.
Yeah, it's I guess most of the ravens are kind of have a good sense of the reach of the eagle and their own speed, but you know, I guess it doesn't pay to miscalculate. So
no.
Yeah, the other interesting thing that I saw once with an eagle was, there was a mink. It was kind of going along the river at Totem Park, and it was going on. And this eagle, I saw the mink going along, and it had something in its mouth, and I wasn't sure what it was. But in hindsight, I'm pretty sure it was a small bird, and it almost looked the size of a winter wren, but certainly no bigger than a sparrow. And this eagle comes, the mink went around a corner where I couldn't quite see it, and I saw this eagle fly in, and I heard this kind of hissing, and then I saw the eagle fly back, and it had something in its talons, and it had stolen whatever that mink had. It actually, and it couldn't have been more than a bite for the eagle. I don't know why the eagle even bothered, but it had stolen that. And then I walked over to where the mink had been, and that mink was really ticked off, and it was kind of sort of a riprap thing to stabilize the bank, and it was kind of under a rock, and I walked over there, and it started coming out after me, and you know, intellectually I know that thing's not that big and it couldn't do a lot of damage to me, but it was still really intimidating just to have it. I think it was really mad at the eagle, probably had to give it up because it knew the eagle could take it if it wanted. But yeah, it was still puzzles me why the eagle thought it was worth flying all the way over there just for that, you know, half a bite of winter wren or whatever it was that it had.
I think sometimes eagles, surprise, you know, they're diving out of the sky and suddenly appearing like over a river otter that has a fish or something. I'll often see the river otter just suddenly splash backwards and release the fish. And I think it's a surprise thing. If the river otter knew what was going to go on, it probably could defend itself. But
yeah, I figure the eagles probably get pretty good at finding food too. I mean, I guess it doesn't pay to let easy food go if you see an opportunity, I suppose. So.
Uh-huh. Are you gonna participate in BioBlitz?
Yeah, I'm planning to. My hope is to get up a mountain. I want to go up Bear Mountain, which is I don't know if you're familiar with Sitka terrain at all, but I was hoping, one of the reasons I wanted to go up there is because it's in the area for the BioBlitz, and in fact it's the highest elevation in the area, I noticed today there's still a lot of snow up there and up high. Especially where I was most interested in getting is above about 3,500 feet, and there's just a different set of plants that come in up there. Plus, there's the opportunity to see some ptarmigan or rosy finches, perhaps. But I'm not sure I'll see much of plants because I think there's still more snow than I'm used to, especially for this time of year. But yeah, that's one thing I noticed. You must be easily accessible. Well, all the mountains with trails around Sitka top out at about, well, under 3,500 feet, and not that there's a lot of them, but Bear Mountain goes up to about 4,200 feet, and I noticed there was a kind of this suite of plants that are just different, you know, that I hadn't ever seen elsewhere. I'm
Oh,
sure
yeah.
they're elsewhere on the island. And you know, things like some of them occur lower elsewhere, like Purple Mountain Saxifrage is one that I know occurs down pretty low by Mendenhall Glacier, as I recall. But it's not very easy to find in Sitka, but it's up there. There was a couple other there's at least one other plant that now it's somebody else found it on another mountain close to town that also gets up above 3,500 feet. But it was previously, I don't think there had been any island records of it until I found it up there on Bear Mountain that time, or the first time I was up there looking. And so yeah, that's one of the things. It's Baranof Island is just really underexplored. I mean, all of Alaska is really, and Southeast Alaska is a little better than a lot of parts of the state, I suppose, but there's still just huge chunks of you know, Southeast that are just really poorly observed, I guess you
Oh
could
yeah,
say.
you might. Is this the first BioBlitz for Sitka?
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, it'd be fun to have the folks from out of town that are, you know, experts in various things. Most of them have actually been here at one time or another over the last few years as they've been brought in to do a seminar and sometimes a workshop. But yeah, it'll be fun to have everybody here. You know, of course, the BioBlitz is just a snapshot, your 24-hour period, find everything that you can, and some things you won't find at some times of year. But I think it'll be fun to see how many different things that we come up with, and just you know, learn from other folks that know a lot more about particular groups that I'm really, really clueless about at this point. So I'm looking
Sometimes
forward to it.
it's exciting to join a group on a subject that you know very little about. Then you can learn quite a bit, and sometimes go off in other directions that you might not normally have considered. I know.
Yeah, I know there's plans to do public walks and stuff I think on both days, both Saturday and Sunday. I'm not sure which day I'm going to try and get up the mountain, assuming the weather cooperates reasonably. Yeah, it'd be fun to get out with some of the other experts, you know, on the day that I'm not wandering around up in the mountains.
I noticed there is an alpine plant walk, or I've never been to that area. Is that can you drive up above Timberline, or?
Yeah, actually, there on Harbor Mountain, which is where one of the walks is scheduled for, you can drive right up to Treeline, basically, and then the trail goes up from there. And so that's one of the peaks that, or the Harbor Mountain, the summit of Harbor Mountain, I think, is around 3,300 feet, maybe not quite that much. I think it's just over 3,000. And there's some. You know, I'm not really sure what the strict definitions of alpine and subalpine are, but you know, there's a bunch of stuff that's there, your cassiopes and your white mountain heather and various other kind of alpine plants, as well as some things that occur sort of up to that level, but also lower down in meadows and mud digs. And so, yeah, it's a good place to see a lot of interesting flowers and things like that. And it's very accessible. That's the other nice thing about it. They redid the trail in the last few years, and so it's a pretty nice, you know, gravel trail. Of course, it goes uphill, but it's a pretty decent gravel trail, and so that'll be a good walk for people to go on. It definitely makes it nicer for getting up and you know, getting above the tree line and being able to see some of those plants that are most easily found there. And that's actually, you know, when I first went up Bear Mountain it wasn't the first time I was up there, but it was the first time I was up there when I had enough sort of plant background to recognize where I recognized enough plants to realize that I was seeing stuff that I hadn't seen before. And when I got up there, and it was, I think it was about 3,500 feet or thereabouts, you know, above that is where I saw these plants that were basically completely new to me at the time. And so that seemed to be another level of alpine. And I'm not sure, it must have something to do with snow and snow persistence. But that's one of the things I'm curious about is why don't these things occur lower? I mean, there are places where there are rocky outcrops or stuff that it seems like they could occur, but they don't occur lower.
Yeah, I wonder about that too. I wonder if it relates to average temperature or something. I know that quite a number of alpine plants, typically alpine plants, can be found along the shore of Mendenhall Lake in Juneau, where Mendenhall Glacier is. So the lake is running year round in the 30 degree temperatures, and I suspect that it's just an environment that sort of duplicates what you find in the alpine.
Yeah, it's been kind of interesting because there are some things that you can find on gravel bars in rivers. For example, where it wouldn't necessarily be as cold, but you know, it's an open, lots of sun, and not a lot of competition. So like the moss campion is one that I know I've seen up high, and I've seen lower along some. And it seems like it's gravel bars of rivers that have an alpine, alpine headwaters, you know, relatively high headwaters. And so there's a few plants that seem to be in those two places, and then there's some that I've only seen up high, and that's, you know, that could be as much from a lack of looking in the right places as anything else, I suppose. But it's just kind of, and a lot of the up high ones, you know, they're going to be under snow for a good chunk of the year, so it's a pretty short growing season. And it was talus fields mostly. Where I was finding them, so it wasn't there definitely wasn't a lot of competition, but you know, it's not hard to figure out, it's not hard to think why a lot of things aren't there. It's always interesting to me to think why the things that are there aren't also someplace else, and maybe it's just like that completely outcompeted, and so you get a place like the Mendenhall Lake where it's just so cool that nothing else really does well, and those guys are good, well enough adapted to cool temperatures that they can be fine there, and without the competition, they do well.
This might be a great year for the alpine there because it's been so late, such a cool spring that a lot of plants or flowers might be in their prime in mid-August.
Yeah, I think up on Harbor Mountain, that's probably about right. I think up above, up at the higher levels, it's still snow. And the snow still hasn't even melted, so it'll be interesting to see. I might have a chance to get up there before BioBlitz and check it out, and I may decide it's not worth going up there for BioBlitz if there's just nothing there, but except for deep snow. But yeah, I was looking at it today from town, and it looks like there's still parts of it anyway, probably several feet of snow.
Wow.
And places where last year, no, 2 years ago was the last time I was up there, I guess. I didn't go up there last year, but 2 years ago I went up there this time, and it was mostly about the middle of August, and it was, I mean, there was definitely still snow fields, but it was lots of snow-free area as well. But this has definitely been, I assume it's the same in Juneau. It's very cool spring and early summer and not even, and almost approaching normal July, but still not anything approaching warm by, you know, in terms of above average overall.
Yeah, our blueberries aren't even coming out in the alpine yet.
Oh, it's going to be a... So do you go up Mount Roberts pretty regularly?
I do. I have a... I always get an annual pass, and alpine is my favorite habitat, so when we get a day when it's not completely socked in, then I can take advantage of it. And it's nice to get whisked to the alpine and to start out there.
Yeah, I hiked up the trail once and came down the tram. And by the time I got up the trail, I was ready to be, I'd carried too much stuff up there and I was ready to be done. So I didn't actually go up into the further alpine, but it's definitely nice to get that head start and be able to go uphill in the alpine country instead of spending all your energy in the lower country.
And it's, they've got a regulation up there with no shooting during the time that the cruise ships are in town, so they don't accidentally hit a tourist. But so the wildlife has become, actually because of the tram, I think it become more abundant up there. Usually several broods of ptarmigan and several broods of grouse to watch. And so it's a neat place to go.
What species of grouse do you have there around Juneau?
It's the only one we have here on the road system would be the sooty grouse. And we have all three species of ptarmigan: the willow, the rock, and the white-tailed. This time of year, the white-tailed tends to be on mountains around 4,000 foot elevation. I'm not quite sure why, but if you get Sheep Mountain is over 4,000, and so if you by going up the Mount Roberts Trail, if you go over to Sheep Mountain, you're almost assured to see a white-tailed ptarmigan. What species of ptarmigan do you have there?
We have the willow and the rock ptarmigan, and we have the grouse also. And what's interesting here, and part of the reason I ask, is that the historically ptarmigan and grouse were both apparently much more abundant than they are now. And of course, squirrels aren't native to Baranoff Island, and they were introduced, I don't remember when exactly, but I think maybe in the 20s or 30s, 1920s or 30s, maybe a little later, but not much. And as I understand it, I should read the publication on introductions to see if there's more details. But my understanding is that the squirrels were introduced as prey animals for the marten that were going to be introduced subsequently. Although the marten apparently don't really eat squirrels that much, they mostly eat voles. But you know, when I was growing up, I heard about the martens being the cause of the ptarmigan and the grouse declines. But you know, in more recent years, as I came to understand how effective squirrels can be at nest predation, my suspicion is that it's actually the squirrels and not the marten that cause the trouble. But squirrels are pretty common on the mainland also, and my impression is grouse aren't that hard to find there either, nor ptarmigan. And so I kind of wonder if it's if the ptarmigan and grouse here on Baranoff Island just they didn't know how to hide from squirrels or to effectively defend themselves, whether that be via hiding or some other means, from squirrel nest predation, and so what became, you know, very the population declined dramatically as a result of the introduction of squirrels. And if that's the case, then presumably the survivors are figuring it out, and maybe the populations will go up. But there are, you know, stories of especially in the winter, of ptarmigan being found in significant numbers down low in muskegs and clearings. And now, you know, not even every year does somebody report maybe one ptarmigan down low in the fall or winter. You pretty much have to go up pretty close to the tree line to find willow ptarmigan, and then to get above the tree line to find the rock ptarmigan. And grouse are, I've met a few people who've seen grouse, and I've heard them a few times, but they're not very common here. They're pretty hard to find. So yeah, it's just interesting to me. That's another one of those interesting things. You know, the squirrels were introduced on Admiralty Island much later, I think in the 70s. Their introduction at the north end, and I've heard that as they move south, the grouse populations kind of declined in their wake on Admiralty. So that's a little more contemporary observation. So, you know, you never quite know what to make of historical ones when it could just have been an anomalous year. And, you know, so there's this picture of all these ptarmigan, and it's easy to imagine that that was like that every year, but it might have just been a one-year sort of thing. So it's kind of hard to know. But, yeah, it's, you know, I wonder how they are not getting decimated by or getting eaten by squirrels there, if in fact it is squirrels that are doing it, I guess. And maintaining relatively, it seems like they're not that hard to find there. I don't know about elevationally if the willow ptarmigan come down low ever or not, but it seems like the grouse are more common there than they are here.
Well, certainly the ptarmigan often are forced lower in winter in order to find food. But and it makes sense that the introduction of squirrels would have been hard on grouse because they're very similar habitats. Squirrels like spruce forests, and so do grouse. Here in Juneau, I think it's kind of interesting. The grouse mothers take their youngsters way up into the alpine. I've seen them in the tops of some of the mountains and so on. And I wonder if, besides food, whether it's a trying to escape certain types of predation that might be more common down in the forest.
Yeah, that could be. I would imagine that open them up to more, you know, some of the open country aerial predators, but they may be less common than some of the, I suppose, marten and, and ermine and squirrels and yeah, I don't know. I suppose, well, even I imagine goshawks also would be a predator to them.
Yes. And one thing I've noticed that when I'm up in the alpine on these, on what you might say is a typical day this year, lots of clouds and fog and drizzle, that the both the ptarmigan and the grouse seem to be much tamer. And I think that's probably, in some sense, this type of weather benefits them from getting preyed upon by aerial predators like eagles.
Yeah, that would make sense.
And hawks and such.
I don't really have a good sense of, I know we don't have, I mean, other than bald eagles here, we don't have a lot of raptors. There's a few red-tailed hawks around and not many, and a few goshawks around, but also not many of those.
Uh-huh.
Occasionally you'll hear about somebody finding
a sharp chin or a Merlin nest, but those seem to be even less frequent. But I don't really know. It seems like maybe raptors are a bit more common in the Juneau area, because there's more land mammals to rodents and various sorts to find for food, and also I think probably more birds, songbirds and so forth. But I don't really know.
That's happening now is a lot of the raptors throughout the state are migrating, and they seem to like the uplift areas around the mountains. And so you can go up above the tram and see quite a variety of raptors, and several birders here take advantage of that and go up and count them and watch them. So that,
yeah, I've seen them doing that a little bit here, but I suspect most of those raptors don't migrate along the outer coast. Actually, one of the things that reminds me of is, do you ever see shorebirds up there during fall migration?
No, I don't.
I have seen shorebird tracks in alpine puddles. I have not seen the shorebirds. And actually, one person, maybe 2 years ago now, reported an upland sandpiper, which is pretty unusual for here. But they saw that on top of Gavin Hill.
Oh, yeah.
So that was probably about 2,700 feet or something, kind of a round tree line. And so I don't know how often they utilize that upper country, that open country up high. And I don't know what species might, because I haven't actually seen them. But I'm curious if you've seen any of that there. Of course, you guys have the wetlands there, Mendenhall wetlands there, which I'm sure is very attractive to most shorebirds. But yeah.
Yeah, I've never, at least in my memory, I don't remember seeing shorebirds in the alpine around Juneau. Certainly when you get in the interior part of the state, it's a nesting habitat for some species, but like surf birds.
Yeah, well, that's part of what I kind of wondered is we definitely don't see as many shorebirds along the beaches in the fall as we do in the spring, certainly not in the concentrations. And in some cases, I think that's just they do a more direct migration south than they do north. In some cases, it's probably more of a dispersed because of the non-breeders or failed breeders and the breeding adults and then juveniles kind of are all spread out. But I also suspect that it's in the spring there is no other habitat. We don't have a lot of meadowy area here, so it's pretty much the tie flats are the best opportunity, and anything up higher would still be snowed in the spring. Well, but by fall, there's quite a bit of open alpine country. So maybe they're coming from tundra breeding areas in some cases, and maybe that's familiar, so they'll use it. Not that they don't use the tide flats, but maybe they're also using the alpine around here.
We do get actually two species nesting here. I think you could call it more the subalpine, but in some cases it's a wide open country. But the greater yellow legs and the Wilson snipe.
Okay, so snipe nests. The yellow legs nest on Kruzoff Island here, for sure. But it's funny. I have never seen one on the muskegs on Baranoff Island, at least not near town. So I'm not sure what the difference would be, but I don't know of any snipe breeding in the Sitka area.
If the yellow legs are there, they'll let you know.
Yeah. That's one of the, even before I did much birding, I remember noticing those when I was hiking up the trail. It seems like the semi-palmated plovers nest kind of in the area as well there, or are they a little further north?
Yes, we do. generally low, but
okay.
The Mendenhall Glacier area, there's quite a few that nest. We've got a real problem in Juneau. We used to have a lot more nesting shorebirds here, but as the population has grown, there's a surprising number of dogs that have proliferated, and I think they've really kept the shorebird population down. Because I know out in the Mendenhall wetlands, we used to have a huge number of least sandpipers that nested, and now you can't even find a nest anymore. And I think in the areas that they nest, they'd be very vulnerable to loose dogs.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. Just even how the Yakutat, there's a paper on, it seems like you went to the Yakutat Aleutian Tern Festival this year, but publication on the birds of Yakutat area, and I can't remember who wrote it right off the top of my head, but it was one of the things that was interesting to me was just how, you know, it's not that much further north than here, but a lot of our wintering, or not a lot, but some of our wintering ducks are actually nesting in Yakutat, like buffleheads, I believe, would nest in the Yakutat area, and some other and how things, something like the Swainson's thrush was another one. That Swainson's thrush is not very common there. They're more common north of there, and they're more common south of there, but apparently that's sort of a soft spot between the coastal subspecies or race that we have here, and then the interior race that's north of there, and the Yakutat area, and it's fascinating to me. I don't quite understand why, you know, habitat that seems to be perfectly acceptable goes unused by birds because they go someplace else, and maybe occasionally use, like Fairless Goldeneye occasionally nest in the Sitka area, but mostly they all leave. And you know, they nest when they nest, they seem to nest successfully, so why don't they do it more often, you know? Or why do these birds that keep flying, why don't they, you know, what drives them to keep moving when it seems like it should be acceptable habitat here for at least a few of them? So the point thrushes, you know, there's decent habitat there, but they apparently haven't colonized it, I guess. I don't know. That's one of the things that sort of is interesting to me about the distributional sort of oddities, I guess, or just interesting things that, you know, I suppose are in some cases a legacy of past ice ages and just the way that you know, their sort of instinct is where to go. But yeah, trying to tease out some of those things and get a better sense of them, and it's easy to assume every other place in Southeast is kind of like here, but there, and while that's true probably in the big picture, there are these subtle differences that I think are really fascinating.
You're kind of fading out here, so I'm having trouble hearing you.
Okay, I don't know what happened there. Well, you know, we've been talking for quite a long time, so I should probably let go. What my plan is to, hopefully this all recorded, and I'll play clips of it on the radio show on Sunday, and I like to post the shows on my website, and if it's all right with you, then I would just post a recording of the whole conversation with minimal editing, just. So the, probably mostly just the front, the beginning part and the end part, and post that as well as a recording on my website, a recording on the radio show that is on my website, if that's all right with you.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
I've probably been intelligible most of the time, but
yeah, sounded fine to me. So it's, I could say it's interesting conversation for me, and I get the impression other people find it interesting as well. It's just kind of I don't consider myself much of an interviewer. I'm more of a, there's interesting things to talk about natural history, and so we just go ahead and have a conversation. But yeah, I look forward to meeting you on, I guess, a week and a half.
Yeah, me too. I hope we'll get a chance to do some wandering and photography together.
Oh yeah, that'd be fun. Yeah, so when are you getting into town?
It's Friday morning.
Okay, Friday morning. And then you're in town through the weekend?
Yeah, coming back, I think, Monday evening.
Yeah, I'll have to make some time to get out and wander around a bit. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, I'm not very familiar with Sitka, so
To compare and contrast with your Juneau experience.
Yes. I lived at Lake Eva for a few years doing research, but
oh wow, that would be interesting.
Built a cabin there and that sort of thing. Back in the
when were you there?
I'm trying to remember it. I think it would have been in the late '60s.
Interesting. Yeah, it'd be interesting to hear more about that sometime.
I did research on Dolly Varden there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm not so familiar with that part of the area, but as I understand it, things change pretty distinctly as you go north out of town, and then you go up. I don't know if you've ever taken a ferry into Sitka, but as you go through Peril Straits, if you're coming from Chatham, you're kind of heading northwest, and then you make a turn to the southwest. At the north end of Baranoff Island, and when you turn that corner there, apparently things are quite a bit different. Going up into Hoonah Sound and quite a bit different. Again, within the context of Southeast Alaska, it's mostly similar, but there are distinct differences in terms of some, I guess, both marine and terrestrial, marine invertebrates and probably algae, and then also plants that are there that don't seem to be on the outside. So some little climate thing, whether it's rainfall or temperatures or a combination of both or what, I'm not sure, but yeah, it'd be interesting to hear some stories about Lake Eva.
Yeah, it was a fascinating place. It was a good time in my life, but
it's been a couple years, I suppose.
Yeah, sometimes with the aging process, you tend to remember things many years ago than you do in the current.
I've heard that it can be that way. I've had relatives tell me that that they remember 30 years ago better than they remember yesterday.
Yep. So if you want stories about Lake Eva, I'll probably be able to give them.
Well, that sounds interesting. Yeah. Well, thanks for getting on the having this conversation with me, I guess, and being willing to be
on
the.
Yeah. Thanks so much for thinking of me, Matt.
I wanted to do something to kind of help let people know about the BioBlitz, and since you were coming over to do the talk and had done some BioBlitzing in Juneau, I thought that'd be a good opportunity to visit. I know I've emailed with you a couple times before, but not not ever talked to you. So nice to at least have a chance. I could say.
I assume you'll give some sort of a spiel on what BioBlitz is going to cover and how important it is for children and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I can go ahead and fill in some of those details, and I'll have a. Hopefully by Sunday I'll have a pretty I think I have a copy of the tentative schedule, which isn't supposed to change too much. So I'll talk a bit about that and definitely encourage people to participate at whatever level they're capable of. Even if that's going out and just bringing back three or four species that they know they recognize, or taking pictures of stuff that looks different to them and seeing if we can figure it out. And
it's a great learning thing. I think one of our BioBlitzes we had over here in Juneau over 400 participants. And
oh wow, that's a lot. I think we'd be lucky to have that many here, but hopefully we'll get a good turnout. I'm sure the weather will make a difference.
Yeah, it's actually I you know, my style is less the blitz and more the long game, and it occurred to me it'd be fun and to maybe try and do sort of an all species big community big year thing instead of, you know, like birders do their big years, but it's just an individual and it's only birds I was thinking it would be fun and maybe to kind of make just a for fun competition out of it or something, probably have to have a core group of interested folks in whichever communities were participating, but just see how many different species you could observe or document, and maybe even more than just the species, but also the kind of those links and connections that we were talking about before. And then just keep track of it over a year and, you know, see what communities to come up with. You could have the experts come over at various times and do, you know, weekend walks, workshops kind of things also as part of that, I think, over the course of a year. But to me, that seems like it'd be I suppose it's got some advantages over BioBlitz organizationally, and it's got some disadvantages because it takes a little more long-term effort, I suppose, in terms of just keeping it going. But I think it'd be a great way to get a lot more sense of what we have here, you know, and discover a lot.
You only got involved in it. One 24-hour period that, like you said, weather itself could make a heck of a difference in what you come up with.
Yeah, and how much difference there is just from time of year. You know, I know that the Juno BioBlitzes were in June, but, you know, they deliberately planned the one here to be in the fall because the plants are all still out, of course, and in fact you can get more plants in the alpine. But it's a lot easier to find fungus, you know, mushrooms and stuff this time of year in the spring.
Yeah.
June, there's just not nearly as many fungus out. And I think the insects are also tend to be better in the fall than in the spring, but it's different, you know, and that's part of what would be interesting to me about doing it over the course of a year is,
yeah,
you could start to look at some of those things but you may be hearing from me on that. I think if I can get it set up on the website so it's easy for people to you know, just save their observations there, I may issue a challenge on Eagle Chat or something to other Southeast naturalists to see what we can come up with in a year.
Uh-huh. And I'll bring a copy of the aquatic insect book for you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it'd be fun to look at. I got a copy of John gave me a copy of your second edition of your of the dragonflies book, and that was nice to have that. I added those species to the wiki, the natural history wiki. I got a lot of species left to add to that just to even get through the resources that are already published. So that's nice because it certainly makes it easier than trying to discover them all yourself, but it's a little bit of tedious to input them all in one at a time. So, but yeah, it's nice to have those resources. And so when you guys have done those books and stuff, it's really helpful for us folks that aren't necessarily experts in those things to get a jump start on what we're seeing.
Well, my general plan is to pick a subject that I don't know anything about, but I would like to do photography and then bring in a couple of experts to do the writing. And then it's almost like taking a class.
That sounds like a pretty good way to do it, actually. Seems like Juno has a good population base to find folks to collaborate with that way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always kind of tough in collaboration to keep everybody working at it, but
yeah. Well, I suppose when it's not your full-time job, and you got other work you have to get done, then it can get to be a challenge.
Yeah. And of course you don't make money at it, but
Yes, don't lose money doing it. It's nice, I suppose.
Yeah, as long as you can pay for the printing costs.
Yeah. Well, I could say I've appreciated having the resources available, so I'm grateful that you've had the chance to do that and found people to work with on those, and so it's been helpful.
Okay, well, thanks, Matt, and I look forward to seeing you in about a week and a half, I guess. And,
yeah, it sounds good. I'll talk to you then. Thank you.
Okay.